Hello, welcome to the Lately in JavaScript podcast. This is episode 24, and as usual, I have here with me Michael Kimsel, direct from Raleigh, North Carolina, right?
Very much so. Good morning.
How are you doing, Mike?
I'm fantastic, but yeah. Do you really want to know? Because I'll tell you.
Have you been hit by the any tsunami waves?
No. It's a bit on the dismal outside, but I think over that way, or maybe it's that one of the directions from here towards the coast, they've been getting a lot of rain apparently yesterday and today, but not much here.
Okay. Well, today we are going to talk about the regular batch of topics of things that have been happening in the JavaScript world. Actually, I want to ask you, Michael, you've been trying Windows 8, anything related with the JavaScript yet that you have tested?
Well, yes, and nothing substantial. I got my editing system, or I got my I got everything updated yesterday. I'm on Windows 8 Pro. Woo! And I got Visual Studio Express for the web installed, and I was going to try to do a bit of JavaScript stuff over the next few weeks, but I've got many other things coming up, client deadlines and conferences and things, so I may have to hold off until November 18th before I dig in. Maybe by next podcast I will have some real experience with it. It's fun and nice. I just haven't done much with it so far.
Well, I think it would be interesting because, as you mentioned in the last episode, there are some things specific for JavaScript to develop applications on Windows 8. So I think it will be an interesting topic to bring it back when at least one of us has more information about it. Well, we're going to continue talking about some interesting topics. This month I would like to talk a bit about somehow improve the way that you work and produce your JavaScript code. And some time ago, we have talked a bit about JS Lint, which is a tool that will help you to eventually find problems in your code. And there is another tool that has a similar, almost very close name, which is JS Hint. I think it's somewhat for the same purpose. I have not tried both tools extensively to compare them, but from what I could understand, they are very similar and give hints on stuff that you probably need to fix or at least improve. And I found this article here about JS Hint, some new features from Elijah Manor, and I decided to take a bit closer to this tool because, sometimes you have bugs in your code and for some reason they did not show up yet. And I tried to, the tool, actually there is a sort of a playground for the tool online, and I tried to paste some a class that I've written for myself, and it's quite it complains a lot about stuff that I'm not even sure if
I've complained about your code many times. I'm glad they're doing it.
But I think you are smarter than this tool because it is complaining even about comments.
Well,
maybe I didn't paste this correctly.
That could be.
Let me try this again.
Yeah, now try that. Linting and hinting tools in general, it's still complaining.
Are annoying.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say. I mean, they can be annoying. They can be useful for you to get an idea of best practices, styles, things that, as you said, things that might cause problems later. The big one for me tends to be cyclomatic complexity, which it looks like this tool covers. That idea of saying, I've got a function call or I've got a method call, and it's got 9 levels of nested code blocks in it, and it's got 30 variable names and that sort of thing. It's not just me. I mean, I look at other people's code. I can sometimes write code like that, and I have done that, and I've left it for other people, but I've found that the older I get, and this could just be that the idea of a tool that measures complexity is just an old person's way of saying, no, you're doing it wrong. But it gives some objective justification for you need to simplify your code. Doesn't mean the code needs to do less, but you need to break this into multiple methods. You need to break this into smaller chunks of code. Maybe to facilitate testing. But even outside of that, there's the idea of, and this is what I get from these complexity testing tools, is that if there's a computer saying, this is going to be hard to understand, and it's nice for me because I find some of these things hard to understand sometimes. And when there's numbers to prove it, this has a complexity of X, and it really should only be half of X. If it's somebody else's code, it makes me feel better, like, ah, yes, I'm not crazy. This tool is saying it's complex. And if it's my own code, it gives me something to shoot for to say I can reduce the complexity of my code somehow. So, and I don't think that they're bad, but relying on that as your only measure of code quality is probably not the best thing to do.
Right. Well, I'm still trying to figure what are these complaints, because it is complaining, for instance, right here. Let me try to increase the font.
That's good. Yeah.
It is saying that there is a curly brace.
What's the line before?
53.
Well, I know the line before is 52, but what's on it?
53. Well, 53, it's here. Oh, maybe he wants for me to put curly braces here.
You write code that way?
Yeah.
I hate you. I hate you. Yeah. You suck.
Yeah. I'm not going to heaven. I know.
End of line 52, put a curly brace.
If I put a curly brace here, it stops complaining. That's what it is saying.
I think so.
Well, to shut him up.
See if that does it, yeah. And then reparse or relint.
I increased the font so much that now I don't.
There you go.
Well, it seems it was it.
Look at that! Woo!
When blocks, okay.
Another one for Special K.
Yeah. Oh, now I disable one complaint and it looks much better now.
Yeah.
Well, I think I need to study this tool better because it is giving a lot of complaints that I do not quite understand. But there are some complaints here that actually clarified one of my doubts. For instance, this one that complains about triple equal sign instead of double equal.
Mm-hmm.
Let me...
Yep.
Well, not just in JavaScript. Actually, in PHP, I was wondering if triple equal would not be more efficient than double equal. Well, for those that are not sure what is the difference, triple equal is requires that the left and right side match exactly, not just the
type.
The type. So if you compare a string with a zero inside with the number zero, the triple equal will not match, but double equal will match. And it's the same in PHP. And I think ultimately the code will run faster if you have triple equal. And the same for the different sign, that you can use exclamation and double equal instead of exclamation single equal. Well, this is interesting, and no matter how experienced you are, these tools are also a good way to learn things that you probably you are not paying much attention, and even if you are very experienced, to assume that you write excellent code, and you probably don't.
You tried
to tell me before.
Well, yeah, I mean, you say, well, I write bugs, and well, yeah, for those people that write bugs, these things are useful, but you know, when you're like me.
That's what I thought. You don't need you are above everybody else.
It's not that I never write bugs. I mean, I sometimes do it for fun. I do it to demonstrate to other people how awesome I am and how much better I am than they are. So yeah.
Well, other than that, I also find some warnings here, like document write can be a form of eval. I wonder what this means. Is this sort of potential security warning, security problem? Like eval could be used to run malicious code, and somehow document write provides that by writing some JavaScript to the page.
Mm. I'm not sure exactly what they're meaning and what the issue is with that, but I'm sure you'll study it and figure it out and become a better developer because of it.
Well, the idea here it is to just mention JSINT as yet another tool to help you to improve your code. Usually these tools are very pedantic, and probably some of the warnings you will always ignore because you don't stand a tool that is too pedantic. Anyway, there is an article here that also posted in the show notes about it from Elijah Manor that covers some of the new features.
Thank you, Elijah. I met him once at a conference. Nice guy. Yeah. Met him face to face. Shook his hand even.
Yeah, so now you qualify to go to heaven because he touched your hand.
No, nothing like that. I mean, I think you need a bit more than that. But it was at CodeStock 2009, I think, in Tennessee.
Yeah. Well, this was an interesting tool to talk about, and moving on with the podcast, I would like to talk also about JavaScript parsers.
Oh, Acorn.
Actually, Acorn, no. It's just one of those tools.
Okay.
Let me screen share here an article that talks about Acorn parser. Well, for people listening to the podcast may be wondering why would be a JavaScript parser interesting for anything useful in the real world. Well, if you have a JavaScript parser, you can somehow process your code and somewhat develop tools like this JSHint and JSLint that can be used to evaluate if you are doing something right. And some other purposes that can always be useful. It's up to your imagination. And in this article here, they are talking about Acorn. And then they also mention other parsers like Uglify.js and ZParser, Narcissus, Esprima. And there are a few others that I do not recall their names, but they can be useful. They some of them transform your JavaScript in abstract syntax T, AST, which is a sort of intermediate form of output that is used by compilers to somehow produce code. I mean, compile code in one language and do something useful with it, like, for instance, compiling it into another language or
some
machine code. And this article covers a bit about it. I'm not going to talk about much of this because this is very specific to the Acorn parser. But I think for those that feel brave enough to develop tools that somehow could be useful to enhance the quality of the code that you produce, or do something useful. Maybe some interpreter that is more safe that you can run in certain circumstances without risking to compromise your environment security. You could use these JavaScript parsers to do something. Improve your code. Well, anyway, moving on with the podcast.
Moving on already? Okay, that's fine.
I'm going to move on and talking about. There's an article here about testing libraries. And well, if you are following me, I'm trying to cover several interesting articles that have been published recently regarding tools that can improve your code somehow or somehow contribute that you produce better code or at least recursive.
Hey, man, who's that handsome devil?
This is amazing. When you want to do something like that on purpose, I'm never able to make it. Let's see. Oh, now it worked out. Well, as was mentioning, there is an article from, I think, Jack Franklin, the author here, that compares some testing libraries for JavaScript. Well, I'm not sure if you can call them the top five. Well, it depends on your point of view. But in his opinion, these are the top five JavaScript testing libraries. And basically cover Jasmine, KUnit, and Mocha, and Buster.js, and YUI tests. Well, I don't know. Michael, do you think this could be called the top five JavaScript testing libraries, in your opinion?
I was just thinking that, and I don't know, but I'm not sure there is a way of calling anything the top five of any. It's I think that that field is too broad. Jasmine, yeah. I've known it to be popular amongst colleagues of mine. QUnit is another. I've used QUnit on occasion. Those are the two that I've used. We actually had a couple of articles on Jasmine in the past in JS Mag. I should say I did use YUI test briefly, not really for anything production, but I've not used Mocha and I've not used Buster.
Yeah.
It looks like Mocha is a Buster 2, our node ones, so maybe that's why I've not used them.
Well, from all these, well, I didn't know YUI test. Well, I'm not a YUI user. Did you use YUI somehow extensively, Michael?
No, it wasn't extensively. This was a few years ago. There was a there was a testing suite that came with YUI 2.
Well, I wonder.
This yes. looks like it's version 3, so I don't know how much it's changed. Probably a lot.
Yes. Well, what I wonder is if this is somehow like one of testing JavaScript testing projects that is. I feel it's missing here, which is Selenium. Is this sort of playback library? Probably not.
Yeah, these are more for testing
code, right?
The code itself and running assertions against the code inside a browser or maybe Node, running in Node headless or something like that. The idea of Selenium would be much more what does the actual browser when it runs it, what is it?
Yeah.
And you're going to do assertions against things.
Right, it's not specific to JavaScript. It could be even for pages that do not have any JavaScript at all. But
yeah.
Well, for testing tools, I think Selenium is somehow mandatory because to test your JavaScript code in a real-world environment on which you use a user interface, I think Selenium seems to be a good project to test. Something that I think it is difficult, and probably it will not work all the time very well because there are all these conditions that change in your browser. Personally, I'm not a big fan of tests, not because you should not do it, but because it's boring. It's not my vocation. I'd rather write code than being a doctor and trying to fix everything.
Well,
I'm more a builder than a fixer.
My standard line on testing is you're going to do it.
Yeah.
You're going to do it. Are you going to be doing it at 2 in the morning on a Saturday when everything's broken, when everybody can see that everything's broken, and it might be costing you or your clients loads of money, or are you going to do it in the beginning during the development?
So
you're going to do the testing.
Are you fan of test-driven development, or maybe not so much?
I like the idea of it, and I did one small project a couple years ago that was entirely test-driven. I forced myself to do it that way, and I got a lot of good out of it. What I'm finding is that a lot of the projects that I'm on, I'm the sole person, and I don't really have the luxury of working with other people to define this and define that and do stuff that I had more luxury when I did that test-driven thing because I was working with a couple other people that were actually very, very talented, much more talented. One was much more talented than I was on the tech side. And so I could trust that other person, and I got to spend some time doing test first. I go through periods where I'm doing tests, not necessarily first, sometimes in JavaScript, sometimes in PHP or Java, whatever it happens to be. And I find that I go through this period where I do it long enough. I don't know if you can see my screen or not, but I do it long enough,
yeah.
Or see my fingers here. It helps. I usually do it at the beginning or during a specific time in the project where it helps me define some of the core models and concepts and some of the core functionality. Once I have enough of that and I know that the tests run and I can make changes and the tests still run, then a lot of times it's how do I put UI layers on top of that and API layers on top of that. And sometimes things change, but and ideally, I would be using tests for everything throughout all of it, but I usually just don't have time.
Yeah.
And yes, it's expensive. I come back to, yes, I am going to be fixing some of these things at 2 in the morning, proverbially speaking, but I feel more comfortable the more tests that I have.
Yes, well, I agree with you. Basically, you just said what I was going to say about it. Ideally, yes, but in practice, no, because it's expensive. If you spend a lot of time ahead building tests for first things that probably will never break because they are very simple and they are not too centric. They are not so critical because the code there will not be executed.
But you probably wouldn't need to be writing a lot of tests for those either. If it's something that you trust, if it's already a library that you've used and a bunch of other things, you don't need to write tests for that. My view is that the tests help you solidify ideas and make sure that as you experiment that your previous assumptions don't change. Or if they do, then you know where to go, where you need to go make those changes. But you said it's expensive, and yet any major project that I've been on, including the JavaScript aspect of things, when we didn't test up front, we don't have time to do it. We got to get this done now. We have 6 weeks to do something. By the time everything was launched and done and finished and then signed off and, hey, version one is done and it's in production, it was 10 or 12 weeks. So you know, you can say, well, we're going to get it done in 6 weeks. Well, we can't afford to test because that's going to add another 4 or 5 weeks onto the beginning of the project. Reality has been that it's never actually done when people think it's done. So put it out, it's launched, and then you've got weeks of people clicking it and the people are actually testing it. They're going through this testing process. So this idea of it's expensive, I think, is largely a false economy. But you have to feel comfortable with knowing where and what to test, and you don't get that comfort level and know when you can skip tests until you've done it a few times. I'm not going to test. I'm not going to write 5 tests to connect to test connecting to a Solr instance and did it work, did it not work. You know what? I'm going to trust that when I run Solr, it's going to run, and when I connect to it, it's going to give me back a document.
Yeah.
The data in the documents may change, and that would be an integration test, but I'm not going to write tests for every single, you know, I added 1 to A, is A now equal to 2?
I
trust that the math library
works. That's the kind of tests that are ridiculous, and you should avoid them because even if they are simple, you spend time on them.
Right.
Well, anyway, regarding the deadlines that you mentioned that they slipped, I think they slipped anyway, regardless if you added tests or not. That's because sometimes your estimations were just wrong. It was not a matter of having tests or not, but obviously fixing bugs takes a lot of time, and I think the circumstances on which tests can be more useful are those that you did not think they would break, but in the end they break and they are very critical for the project.
Right.
So between not having any tests at all and having tests for everything, I think there is a middle ground on which you can choose those components that are more critical and totally cannot fail, like sensitive parts, like those that deal with money, or those that deal with other critical aspects like people's lives or whatever is the scope of the project. I think you can choose those parts.
I cannot argue with somebody advocating pragmatic middle ground. There you go.
But that's my circumstance. That's my circumstance because I only work for myself, so I cannot speak what happens when I work. Because if my code breaks, it's my loss. it's the loss of my own business. In your case, that you provide consulting to other companies. If you lose, if your code breaks, probably you get sued by those companies, and your loss is just not just a matter of time or emotional. Yeah. You can actually have financial damages. Yeah. I don't know if you actually sign contracts on which you are obliged to.
I'm not at liberty to say. Actually, it varies between projects, and typically that, for better or for worse, typically that aspect is normally glossed over, sometimes to their detriment, sometimes to mine. But even if it's just, hey, fix this, okay, that fix may take me 5 or 6 hours, and that's time spent that I'm not doing new stuff, whether my own stuff or paid client projects, so.
Yeah. Well, I think this testing topic is very interesting. Actually, it will raise that. For some people, it's very passionate about the topic. They certainly have strong opinions about this, whether you should have full tests or just those that, for instance, you see many projects that are tests after the fact. They only had tests after they found bugs. So they only had tests to see if the bug is still there or not.
Sure.
I confess that somehow I do this even in some projects, components that are critical, that they cannot fail because they are complex. And if you mess with some code in one point, it will affect the functionality of code in other points. And you may be fixing something and breaking something else, and that's annoying. And tests are definitely very useful to make sure you do not release crappier code than you had before.
Such a lofty goal.
Yeah.
Suck less than you did last month, yes.
Well, that should be the definition of progress. You don't want to walk backwards.
Yes.
Well, anyway, but moving on with our podcast, what's that?
I'm going to have some Red Thunder, baby.
Oh, okay. We don't have that here, I think. Is it energetic? The power?
Oh yeah. Drink? I'm gonna be powered up.
Well, the only power drink I have here is not really on topic, but
nice.
This one was given to me like 11 years ago in the PHP International Conference. I wonder if there is a version of these for JavaScript.
Because
sometimes I definitely could use them. JavaScript power drink. Well, anyway, I was moving on with the podcast. Now I'm going to talk about yet another JavaScript editor. Let me screen share here. Okay, this one comes from VMware people. Well, you were talking about the VMware. You are using your machine to virtualize your operating system.
Spring Source. I mean, they're owned by VMware, but Spring Source is kind of their own thing.
Yeah. Well, basically, this is like any other editors for JavaScript. I was trying to see if they have the demo or something. Well, they have the project page here in GitHub. But, well, if I click on these screens, they will not get bigger. They're already in the final size. So I was trying to see if they would do something unusual. Well, I did not find much much to be that I could say that it is unusual. But, the author gives certain explanations on why he decided to create yet another JavaScript editor. Well, these editors are always useful. I don't know if we need many of them. Anyway, what they could be useful is for environments on which you can develop your projects on the so-called cloud, on which you are editing code that is probably hosted in some version control repository, and the actual server-side platform will save the updates to the version control repository. That is interesting. Michael, did you?
I thought I had seen a demo video of this at some point.
Probably you were thinking about the one from Adobe that we talked.
No, in
past episodes.
Because I'm not huge into Spring, but I do keep up with some of the stuff because of their Grails thing, and I could swear this came across in some email or feed maybe a week or so ago, and I thought I clicked on it. Maybe I didn't, but the one thing there is that they do link to, I mean, you had a link there to the GitHub stuff, and it's almost becoming passé for somebody to write yet another JavaScript editor, but the meta interesting thing to me is that so many people are now sharing so much of their code, and things like Cloud9, when that came out maybe a year or so ago, it's like, oh, this is a big deal, and it kind of was, but not just, hey, this is a great tool, but I think the idea of how to build these sorts of things and will become, in some sense, less exciting, but probably more useful and more ubiquitous over the next couple of years. I think hosted cloud editors, I think we're still a ways away from those being generally useful, because I don't think they've quite hit the level of features, but also the use cases for workflow.
Yeah.
Again, things like, is it going to be able to run all my tests? Am I going to be able to do, is it going to be able to integrate with other stuff I have? I have a test database. Do I host my test database in the cloud then too? There's so many things that we take for granted on local dev machines. And I think it's going to be a while before an entire dev environment really makes it in the cloud. But we may see things like, hey, you've got an embedded SQLite and we're going to run that in your browser for your test data, and then you're also going to deploy to SQLite in your server environment, wherever this gets deployed. So as we blur the line between deploying an application and editing it and hosting it someplace, we may see that these become more ubiquitous.
Well, as I was looking here, I stopped screen sharing, so let me see if I get it again. Well, at least it has some interesting features. I don't know if the others have these features like integration with JS Lint for providing markers for errors and warnings on things that probably you need to fix on your code. And there is also some integration with JS Doc to extract documentation from comments. Well, yeah. As you said, I'm not sure if this is mature enough for you to use.
If not used
on the cloud,
if not used directly, then learn from what's the direction that these tools are going in. Is there something that you could use this for in your maybe in internal workflow? The other flip side of this, these idea of hosted tools, code editing tools, is in some sense things like WordPress and Drupal and whatnot, web-based content editors, we have content management systems, and there's been this huge divide between content management and code management, code development. We may see more of a blurring of those at some point. So maybe some of the tools that people have been developing to be focused on HTML, JavaScript, and so on, maybe those will be adapted more for hosted, live hosted content management with good version control management, things like that.
Yeah, well, I think, at least from what I understood, you are not required to use this tool, this editor in particular, in the cloud. I think you can use it on your own machine.
Sure, sure.
If it is better than your regular IDE tool, whatever you use.
Nothing's better than my IDE.
Yeah, especially yours, right?
I paid for it.
What
cash
is
money.
The name of your IDE? It's Special K IDE.
No? Oh, I wish. Special Kide.
Special K.
I use PHP Storm a lot when I'm doing PHP stuff. I use Zen Studio for some things. Zen Studio just had version 10 beta come out. I downloaded it, have not run it yet, but I hope to on November 18th. And IntelliJ, when I'm doing Java stuff and Grail stuff.
Yeah.
Actually, in RubyMine, I played with RubyMine for a Ruby project a couple months ago. That was fun, too. I like JetBrains projects, or products, I should say. I like them.
Now that you mention ZenStudio, the latest version, it seems they have some integration with PhoneGap.
PhoneGap, too, yes.
Well, because the Zen realized that many companies want to develop mobile first, and if you use PhoneGap, there is the Cordova project, which is the open source version.
What's interesting, you say mobile first, because I've heard that phrase uttered a few times, and I've not actually taken it to mean make a mobile app first, but design with mobile dimensions in mind. Design your UI. You know, what are your core things? Make those for a tablet first, or a smartphone for Android or iPhone first, and grow the website, or if it's an application, grow the web application, the desktop size from those cores.
Yeah.
It's great that they're putting Cordova in. That's kind of cool, and you know, whatever. More power to them. More on the UI side, I think, would be a nice thing from ZenStudio, but trying to do UI stuff for the web inside Eclipse is, for me, has been problematic in the past. So
yeah, well, I did not take a look what they, because they just announced it, but it seems they have some visual tools to create basic user interfaces. Probably mm-hmm. if you want something more sophisticated, you will do it with separate tools. I think your perspective is interesting.
So do I.
Regarding mobile first.
I get that all the time.
I think it just means develop an API first and then wrap your mobile or web interface around that API. Somehow I've been doing that for years. It's probably nothing new. It's a design pattern, if you can call it that. Basically, we have a service layer on which you wrap your... I'm not sure if wrapping is the right word, but that's another kind of wrap.
Oh, okay.
I meant call your API from your web layer.
Not wrapping.
Which would be also a layer that you would call from your mobile application. And so basically this mobile first thing is not really nothing new, just a new name for something that used to be an old pattern.
I was calling my API, sorry, from my mobile.
Okay, all has great sense of humor.
Ah!
I think that probably would deserve a whole show dedicated to it, whether how to fit a mobile development in your web application development, your cloud. Now they call it cloud.
Oh, yeah. Back in my day, it was just a server.
Yeah, right. We are doing that since 15 years ago, and now they call it the cloud. It's probably...
Because you're an old man. I mean, no, because you're a senior developer.
And I use the old names.
Mm-hmm.
Old names for this so-called new things that are still old.
Yeah.
Well,
go back to your floppy disk and your token ring.
Yeah, I think I have some floppy disk somewhere in one of those boxes in the back, but it's getting... Well, it's not getting dust because it is inside the box, but...
The box is getting dusty. I think we understand the idea of sort of abstraction of layers there. I get it. Yeah. I get it. It's in a box.
It is all wrapped.
I'm on a boat!
Well,
different song. Sorry.
Moving on with the podcast.
Please.
I'd like to now mention just briefly an article that I found interesting about an obtrusive JavaScript.
I don't think we're able to do anything briefly. I don't know why you even say you're going to mention that briefly, because we've never been able to do anything briefly.
Yeah, that's Mitch trying to convince myself that I need to rush to the end of
I'm
the gonna podcast.
I'm going to put a timer on, and you've got, sorry, Jason, just the luck of the draw. You've got reset. You've got one. I'll
30 seconds.
No. You can have. Where did it go? What the heck? Zero. No. Okay. 1 minute. You got 1 minute because that's the lowest. Go.
Okay. Well, this is just a very simple article that mentions something that we already been doing for a long time, but well, at least for me, I would not think of calling it an obtrusive JavaScript, which is basically to put your JavaScript separate from your HTML. Well, they show you here a sample code of how it used to be. Actually, in many sites, still like this, like you have some JavaScript buried in the HTML tags. And according to the author, thanks to jQuery, people start using code more like this, on which you define the hooks.
You do see, you got 20 seconds left, right?
Okay. Basically, you have code like this that hooks on the JavaScript, the HTML elements, using some calls that register event as some code to handle those events.
Well, that was
somewhere else.
Was it?
And I was just, yeah, well, that's basically it. What I was going to ask you, Michael, do you write totally an obtrusive JavaScript, or maybe not?
It was supposed to do the ring. It was supposed to do the, what the heck? Yeah, iPhone. Okay. Do I write unobtrusive JavaScript? My JavaScript is so unobtrusive, it lives on somebody else's server. Like, it doesn't even get loaded on the page. It's just, if somebody wants it, they could go download it separately. There's like a little button that says, do you want this JavaScript? And you click it, and it comes down separately. On a somewhat more serious note, I like to think I'm getting better at unobtrusive JavaScript. I'm not perfect at it, but I have, the more I've done JavaScript over the past several years, many, many years, but the more I've done it on moderate-sized projects, the more I've understood the, and this with code in general, the longer-term maintenance aspects of it. To me, unobtrusive JavaScript is more about maintenance and ability to go back and make changes later. Testing is, I wish it was a higher priority, but there's some benefits to testing there. So, yes, I'm getting better, but that's only because I really sucked at it before.
Yes, but, well, I think if you do not write all your code in an unobtrusive way, well, as it is defined here, in my opinion, you will not go to hell if you do not do it. But as you as you just mentioned, it becomes easier to test if your code is actually separate. But also another point I want to bring is that being an obtrusive, it does not mean that it cannot be on your page. I think it just has to be separate from the actual HTML elements that you are
ideally
going to.
Ideally, there's a separation there.
Yeah.
Like a parting of the Red Sea.
Well, in my case, in many circumstances, I have JavaScript generated with server-side components, so it gets naturally buried in HTML that is also generated for the same purpose. I don't know if you use any frameworks or tools on the server side that actually do that.
Nope, none.
So if you do your form validation generation,
you do it
manually, so you have to do it the server side
and
code.
And you do it manually.
Yes.
And I do it manually. I do everything by hand.
I try to do not repeat myself. So I use some code on the server side that generates the JavaScript for the actual validations from the same code.
I wrote my own operating system. I do everything by hand. build my own servers. I fab my own chips. I make my own silicon, for goodness sake. I can't trust that. I would get obtrusive silicon if I didn't do that.
Yeah, but so I was not talking about developing your own code.
But everything.
I use components that actually generate the JavaScript for the forms. So it's both the...
Yeah, I know you do. I know you do. And I'm just saying... Oh, sorry, backwards. Okay. That's all I'm saying. It's all... carry on. You said you're going to be brief. Or maybe,
I was wearing briefs for the other part, but that's what I was trying to talk about.
Okay.
So you are saying I'm going to hell. But,
no, I'm just saying you're going to the next topic, is what I'm saying.
Okay, it's not hell, fortunately. Well, you are right. We need to move on because we are getting closer to the end of the podcast.
I think we hit the end about 10 minutes ago, but we're still rolling. So,
well, there is one last topic before the regular sections that we end the podcast, which is, in the case, one thing that I thought you would be familiar, but in the end, you seem you are not, which is about the Raspberry Pi devices.
Yeah, it's not me. I mean, I spam you know about them. It, but I only spam about them. I don't actually know anything about them.
Yeah. I heard about that spam. Well, actually, for those that are not familiar, Raspberry Pi is a sort of a Linux box that costs, I think, it's $25, right? And it's a very small device that you can use to develop any device that has some functionality that could be useful. And since it runs on Linux, it could also run on Node.js. But there is an article here that explains what you need to do to make Node.js run well on Raspberry Pi devices. Well, I've never used a Raspberry Pi device.
I haven't
it's
interesting, either.
But I do not have the time. But I think it's interesting, but I do not have the time. And so, but I'm sure there is other people that is always interested in on these things. So on this topic, that's all I wanted to comment about. And fortunately, this time it was brief. So we are going to move on to the next topic, which is one of our regular sections on which you comment the latest classes published on the JS classes.
Oh,
and
this Spotify month, running my ears.
We had a few, not many, but a few classes to talk about. Michael, from these, I think, four of publishing this month, which ones would you like to mention?
Well, talk about the top two there, the HTTP client, which serves as the basis for the JS GTV2C, which is kind of a mouthful there. But both of those from, I hope I'm going to say his name right, Jurij, which is probably a roughly equivalent to George, maybe Jurij. I was thinking sometimes names are very similar between Mikhail and Michael and so on. You've got that up. I've got it up on my end. I don't have it up on my shared screen, though. But the HTTP request or the HTTP client object is more or less a basic class wrapper around the ability to post, to do posts and get HTTP client stuff. Interesting that what he didn't implement, it would have been interesting to implement, to see him implement, I guess I should say, put and delete. Now, a lot of server-side environments can't directly handle put and delete methods, or maybe even head, but to have an HTTP client that would support all of those would be more useful to more people in more situations. That's just my that's my initial thought. But I think he'd initially done this as the basis, as you'd pointed out before, for the other class. If you want to bring that up, and Jurij,
are you able to screen share yourself?
I'm not sure I should because I might break something this time. Well, because I'm not using the normal browser that I use, and it might. Can you just bring up the other thing? And
I can, but it only shows when I'm talking.
Oh, okay. I'll try. I'll try. Let me give
it. Worst case, you.
I brought it up in IE. That'd probably be fine. You got it there. This other one is the JS GTV2C. This is a object that uses that HTTP component to call the Google Translate API to do text translations.
Yeah.
So what is the EP license? So this is GPL3. Okay. If you brought up that sample and looked at it.
Well, it's nothing sophisticated, but. I think it's useful. It extracts the translations of text that you give in some input language, and you expect it to be translated to some output language, but it can also detect when the server API change the detected language. So if you assume it's English, but it's some other language, it also returns the other language that it was changed. And this is useful for you to, if you are integrating this in the translation form, you can update the input that defines the
pull-down
initial language
yeah.
of your text. Well, basically, this is to provide a similar interface to Google Translate on the web, but using the Google Translate API, so you can do it in your own site.
Yep.
Well, this may have its uses. Well, anyway,
thank you to the Czech Republic.
Yeah.
Well, to all of you, yes.
That's great. We did not have many contributors from the Czech Republic, so it's always great to see people from other countries, not from the same countries that the majority of the contributors send their packages. But moving on with the classes that were published in this month. This time I would like to also mention a class from Gabor Martini. He's already a developer that has submitted another package. And this time he just created, actually submitted a class that does things with prime numbers. Like decomposing a number in factors that once multiplied, they give the original number, and it decomposes the number in prime numbers. Prime numbers are useful for many math purposes. So if Gabor developed this class, he probably has a good use for it, because in abstract, probably just an interesting academic example, but it probably has a useful purpose for this class. And the other class that I wanted to mention, another one from Carl Olds, which became a regular contributor of the site. It's somewhat is related with other classes that he already submitted, not just here to the JS classes site, but also to PHP classes site. And in this case, he just sends an AJAX request to retrieve an RSS feed, and it parses the RSS feed to return its value, so you can do something useful with them, like displaying the RSS feed on a web page, and eventually this could be used to display some activity on some server that is updated via an RSS feed, and using AJAX requests you can update the page without reloading it. So this seems to be an interesting class from Carl Holtz from Canada. Kudos to him for this class too. On this section of the classes, we do not have more to comment on this month, so let's move on to our final section, on which Michael will comment about the very important topics.
In my world,
being covered.
I've got a whole bunch. I'm going to make this quick. Stop what you're doing, because I'm about to ruin. I'm not going to go there. We've got JS Mag. We've got a few articles coming up in the next issue. It should be out sometime, ideally Thursday, but I think we've got some production conflicts this week, so it may not be out till Saturday or next Sunday. We've got an article on reflows, when content gets reflowed and or repainted, and some optimizations around that, how to optimize that. We've got another one from Mike Schwartz, who has continually basically documenting his development of his Silk.js server-side JavaScript, continuing on in that series. We have an article on playing snippets of video, and another one which we may have. Actually, it looks like that is actually, I'm actually pulling this up right now. Creating a simple message bus web project using require.js for dependency management, jQuery for event dispatching, and _JS, all written in CoffeeScript with Jade as a templating system. I think we'll have that out as well. It's just, said before, there's always this, we've got these, they're in the pipeline, they're in various stages of being edited, and if they don't hit this month, they'll hit next month. But that's what's on doc, or on the docket for right now.
Yeah. Well, that's always an interesting batch of topics. Some are continuations of previous issues, right? And well, for those that did not actually watch this podcast before, maybe you would like to mention about the subscriptions of your magazine, right?
Well, I guess a few things. We do monthly PDF publications, monthly magazine, PDF publication, suitable for print, but we don't print. People can get a 12-month subscription either from now into the future or maybe earlier batches of 12 at a discounted rate. You can buy that online at jsmag.com, and we're always looking for authors, contributors, writers, and whether it's you've got an idea for just one article you'd like to write or perhaps a series. I actually talked to a couple people this week about potentially doing a series, though I think given their schedule, it may not work out. Plug into the month, something like that. We'd like to get back to some more continuous content in the series that we've had in the past. So if you've got an idea for something, anything to do with JavaScript, like to talk, michael@jsmag.com.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And do not forget that you pay.
Oh, yes, we do, and it's usually not a huge amount, but we do pay for articles. As a matter of fact, and I'm forgetting his name. I'm blanking on his name. Goodness.
Archers.
Yeah. Who wrote a bunch, but who has done loads of JS classes and stuff for you in the past? Archer Sosens. Yes. He has written for us a number of times in the past, and hopefully will again in the future. But I think he was it on this podcast a few months ago that he said that he bought a new MacBook with the money from the JS Mag articles.
Yeah.
So I think that's, it adds up. It's enough that if you want to buy something serious like that, you can. So we do pay. We pay the editors as well, too. We pay the authors, pay production, pay everybody.
Yeah.
Because that's what we like to do.
Right. Well, finally, actually talking about Arthur's, not about something that he has done visibly, but he is one of the beta testers of one feature that I've been working on for quite a few months that will be hopefully released this month coming of November, which will somehow make it more fun for authors to submit their classes to the site. And
are you going
to
pay them? That would be fun.
Somehow will be rewarded, not necessarily with money, but with something funnier than before, hopefully. And actually, Arthur's is just one of about 10 beta testers that have been giving feedback, and it has been very useful, and they are very enthusiastic with what is coming. I'm dying to talk about it, but I have
don't die, please.
To next episode, because
you should be paying some cold hard reals. Is that how you say it? Give them some cold hard reals.
Yes. Well, for some people, they are being paid for some artwork that is being used.
I'm just making sure I'm saying the word right. That's all.
Yes. Anyway, as I was saying, we do not have the time this episode, and it's still not ready. I'd rather not talk about it, because between now and then things probably will change, but I think it will be a great thing to talk about next month. And other than that, and on my part, that is all. I don't know if you, Michael, you want to remind about...
I've got two things.
IndieConf?
No? I'm going to try to share my screen. I'm going to try, because I made a separate tab, and hopefully this will work. Yeah. Two things. You tell me if you see that. Do you see that?
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
We've just got a little over 2 weeks. I think we had a little under 3 weeks to IndieConf. This is our third annual conference for primarily freelancers. If you're a web freelancer, web designer, developer, graphic person, writer, somebody working in that space.
Bill Gates is coming?
No, I wish. but even somebody like people who are primarily marketers, if you're primarily working on the web, you'll find a place. I was talking with people the other day, said, well, I do home inspections. I do actually met a guy who does pet ambulance services, which is pretty niche. I had to think for a moment. There will be some sessions there that will make sense and will give value to people like that, though the majority of people there will be in the software business. There's not much in terms of actually coding sessions. There's a lot of things like how to monetize your website. You see that copyright stuff, how to protect your work online, how to deal with lawyers and attorneys and contracts and things like that. We got a CPA coming and so on. So it's going to be an interesting mix this year, as it has been the last few mix. We've got some old speakers, got some new speakers. If anybody's interested in attending, you can register with the code JSClasses at IndieConf.com. Click the little registration button, and it will take you directly to the registration page, and you can put in enter promotional code, enter JSClasses, and you'll get a nice discount. Feel free to email me or just contact me through the IndieConf website if you have any questions. Last, I would like to impose on you just for a moment, Manuel. May I do this?
Well, it depends.
I've done it.
Oh.
I'm asking for testers. If anybody out there watching this would be interested in testing this hosted virus scanning service, please go to virusaid.com and sign up. Go to that website, sign up.
I remember you talking about this some months ago.
And I had to, about a year ago, and I had to put it together. I had to put together virus scanning for a particular project. I extracted it and put this up and was piloting it, using it as a web service. I've had to, for a couple of reasons, I've had to do some under-the-hood changes to both sets of code, but I've moved this to a different server. I've updated some of the stuff that needed to be updated from a security standpoint. So this is sort of ready to be tested again. I'm using it regardless, but I want to see if other people would have a need for it. And my initial thought was, I'm not going to press this. People won't have a need for it. But the bigger thing that I've noticed, and you may notice it, we were talking about the cloud. There's loads of cloud services out there, Heroku and CloudBees and so on. A lot of these, a lot of cloud services that do not, let me close that, you do not get access to the file system. You can't just take files and just store them on the file system and say, well, I'm going to run Clam, or I've got McAfee, and I'm just going to let it scan this directory. You're not allowed to do that. You're on a scalable, dynamic scalable system. You don't have direct write access to the file system. So things like, trivial things like, I want to run Image Magic, or I want to do this, I want to run that, I want to run a virus scanning system. These aren't things that you can easily implement on your own system, because you don't actually have your own system when you're in the cloud. So if anybody's out there running on PHP Cloud, or I guess it's AppFog now, or CloudBees or Heroku, and you'd like to help test this out, please let me know. Thank you.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. Well, maybe actually you can come back to it in a future episode, since you provide an API. Well,
yeah,
it's that, always interesting for people to integrate in their applications.
Yeah, if anybody, and I'll just throw it out, if anybody would like to write a JavaScript class for it, reach out to me. I'll give you access through the API, I'll give you a key, and you can knock yourself out.
Well, that would be interesting.
Yeah.
Well, with that note, we practically ended this podcast. There is nothing else to add, I think. So on my behalf, I'd like to thank you, everybody, for being patient and listening to us for more than 1 hour. So bye, all.
Bye-bye.